RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Wednesday morning at RCR is Legal Hub morning, as always, very popular. In fact, I know many of our listeners can't wait for Wednesday. Katie Ashby-Coppins is with me again. Hi, Katie.
Good morning, Paul. How is everybody today?
I'm good, thank you. And I think most people are okay. And we have a special guest on this week's Legal Hub. And Katie, you can do the introductions if you don't mind.
Thank you, Paul. Well, it is a privilege to be able to have Emma Cameron on with us today. Now, I got to meet Emma in the last couple of years, and I just have to say she's one of the most phenomenal souls that I've had chance to meet. And we actually only just got to meet in person the other day. So welcome, Emma.
Welcome. It's great to be here.
Hi, Emma. I'm Paul.
Hi, Paul.
Nice to meet you too. How did you describe Emma, Katie? The soul word was in there. I caught that.
Oh, she's just an incredible soul. And it's just been a real bit of a journey. And it's just so great to know that there's other people out there that are doing great things. And so Emma was born in New Zealand. We can call her a Kiwi. She's got a Master of Studies in Jewish Christian Relations from the University of Cambridge, and a Master of Laws degree from Victoria University of Wellington. And I think this probably sums it up perfectly. She passionately believes that evil only prevails when good people do nothing, and encourages everyone to do what they can that's within their sphere of influence to do. Small things each day to stand up for what is right. Change happens one action at a time.
That's really cool, Emma. I'll tell you why, because I keep feeling there's a lot of evil about at the moment, but that's probably for another day to talk about. But obviously, good people have not been doing too much lately, maybe.
I hear you, Paul, on that one.
Yeah. Everybody, I hope, is hearing me on that one. Okay, let's get underway. And Katie, Health and Disability Commissioner, opportunity to give feedback on what?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. The Health and Disability Commissioner has opened up the opportunity to give feedback due by the end of this month, so 2 weeks away, on both the Code of Rights and the Health and Disability Commissioner legislation. And so that's an opportunity to give feedback if you've had a case that you've tried to get before the commissioner and it hasn't been dealt with. And we'll get into a few other of the nitty-gritties about the the Health and Disability Commissioner soon. But the opportunity to give feedback is one we encourage everybody to do so, especially if you've had experience, and especially if you've had experience which could be improved upon, because the issue is about resolving complaints and concerns of people who use health services.
Okay. What's its origin?
Why don't I hand that over to Emma?
Okay, so that's a great question. It actually comes out of the Cartwright Report. So the Act and the Code were created following what came to be known as the unfortunate experiment.
I remember that. Yep.
A little bit too early for me, Paul, but in 19-
I can even remember the doctor's name, Herbert Green.
Yes, correct.
Off the top of my head.
Well done. In 1966, an unethical study led by Herbert Green at National Women's Hospital followed women with significant changes to their cervical cells without treating them properly. This occurred without the woman's knowledge or consent. 20 years on, many had developed cervical cancer and some had died.
So they were kind of lab rats.
100%.
Oh, dear. I remember that time, actually. That was a huge scandal, actually.
It was. And my understanding is that the commission was actually televised, and it certainly led to a great deal of public outcry when the facts became known by the wider population.
The women involved had no knowledge at the time, right? They just had no knowledge.
No knowledge.
And that's why I think it's called an unethical experiment. Yeah. They weren't given informed consent.
Well, where have we heard that before?
And look, history has potentially repeated itself, particularly now we can see where the Health and Disability Commissioner has recently made a decision in May of this year, finding that Rory Nguyen didn't get informed consent with respect to the risk of myocarditis, and as a consequence, she made recommendations that the guidelines of the Health New Zealand and also the pharmacy be updated to include that risk. Now, I think that falls way too short of what needs to be amended in respect of these products. My first frustration is this is just way too late. May 2024, when Rory passed away in November 2021. In that time, we've had the rollout of what we've had, the traffic light system, which gave rise to the vaccine passes. We had the approval and then rollout of the vaccination program to the children. You know, this is just too late, little too late, when, you know, a lot of could have been done before that. And look, that just giving people a warning about myocarditis is also completely insufficient so as to give them full informed consent about these products. One, people need to be told they're a new class of drug that received special approval, that there were risks, many still unknown, and to have at least gone through the data sheet risks, which were known and specified as early as February 2021. So, look, if they were to do it properly, that's what informed consent looks like.
They don't know that.
Oh, well, the whole reason that the Health and Disability Commissioner exists is to avoid this situation happening again.
Okay, so people can make submissions, right? So, or feedback. What sort of feedback do you think that would be?
Well, let's get on to maybe what they're asking for, which is a bit interesting. So, look, a bit of a step back in time. The Health and Disability Commissioner's job is to protect and promote the rights of people using health and disability services. Now, there's the expectation that everybody will use health services at least once a year, and I think it's just shy of 50,000 people use disability services in our country. And there is a code, and there's also an act. Now, what the code does is it outlines certain rights, and I think there's about 9 or 10 of them.
There were 10 rights in the code.
Thank you. So the right to fair treatment, the right to dignity and independence, the right to appropriate standards. I think the key ones here are right to effective communication and the right to be informed, the right to choose and be able to consent, and the right to support. And I think the last one is the right to have your complaint dealt with or something to that effect. The right for your complaint to be taken seriously. So that's the code. The code is what guides, or the principles that guide the Health and Disability Commissioner, but also doctors and medical professionals in New Zealand. And then we've got the legislation, which sets out what the Commissioner can do, the roles of the Advocacy Service, which looks to assist people before their complaint gets to the Commissioner, and the role of the Director of Proceedings, which we'll just park to one side for the moment. So there's a few limitations. No right to patient confidentiality, no right to health information privacy, no right to access to health services, and no right to receive treatment within a specific timeframe. But I think most importantly, and what I was just mentioning before, is there is also a principle within the legislation that things will be dealt with fair, simple, speedy, and efficiently in respect to resolving of complaints. So I think that that's pretty important to keep in mind, and I'm sure a lot of people possibly feel that they're not getting that under the legislation or the system as there currently is.
I'll just jump in and note that there's a little bit of a tension there. There's a tension between fairness on the one hand, but also, you know, timeliness, speedy, efficient resolution of complaints. And I think the Commissioner leans too much on, you know, efficiency, on speed, and not enough on the fairness, justice aspect.
In their practice or in how these items are written?
in the practice.
Because I'm thinking, I'm looking at those code of rights and I'm thinking, yeah, they broke that one, they broke that one, they broke that one, you know, and just going down the list. How come there is no right to patient confidentiality? Am I missing something? I'm just a simple person. I would have thought that would have been up there, and no right to health information privacy, no right to access to health services, no right to receive treatment within a specific time frame. Am I missing something there?
Sure. So I'll just jump in there, Paul. So no right to privacy. The reason we don't have those rights in the code is because they're covered by the Privacy Commissioner. And the reason we don't have access rights in the code, now, it's a big debate, but the issue is if you put access rights in the code and then you're somebody who's waiting on a waiting list, that has all sorts of policy implications for government. And so that's why there was obviously a decision not to put access rights into the code. Whether or not that's the right decision, well, that's why everyone should have their say.
Just doesn't feel right to me, but what do I know?
I think it's perhaps, too, the difference between a code and, operational issues. So, you know, the code is your individual rights as a human, whereas the other issues, which are limitations, are, you know, patient confidentiality is available to you under other legislation, and the right to privacy is available under other legislation. But the speediness at which you can get health services and things
there.
Like that
yeah.
might not be there. You know, if you're waiting on a lung transplant and you are dependent
like, hurry up,
on
where's my lung?
Match. That's exactly right. They don't grow on trees.
No. Okay, so where were they in the last 3 years, do you think, the health? They must have been swamped.
There's been definitely an uptick in cases, and Emma can probably elaborate on those.
Yes, in the consultation document that the Health and Disability Commissioner has put out, the Health and Disability Commissioner certainly notes that complaints are increasing. And that's obviously a concern to the Health and Disability Commissioner.
Yeah, I guess they have limited resources, right? They're just used to a background level of this, not any uptick.
That's exactly right.
That's true. And reading the consultation document carefully, reading between the lines, there's almost a sense in some places that the Health and Disability Commissioner is trying to find ways to deal with this increase in complaints. And it seems to me that the Health and Disability Commissioner is wanting more direct resolution between people who make complaints and the providers of healthcare to kind of lessen their own workload. And I don't know if I'm happy about that, Paul.
No, I can probably see why, because can I just hit you with a scenario that comes off the top of my head? I've suffered, let's say, a bad reaction to something. I go back to where I got it from. I've realised already I didn't get really informed consent, and I'm saying, hey, I want to resolve this. What can you do? Well, they're not going to engage, are they? They want to see the back of me that as soon as I walk in the door, if that's the case. So that's never going to fly, is it?
That's a great question. I think one thing we should perhaps mention here is that when people make complaints, there were many different motivations why people make complaints. Some people want justice. Some people want accountability. Some people actually, they just want their experience to be heard. And so this is where for some people, you know, if you say to them, go back to your provider, you know, they might, depending on their motivations, feel very uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, because the initial problem could have come from there.
Exactly.
Well, it generally does. And it's almost a situation where you've got cops investigating crooked cops or, you know, investigating their own, and that gives rise to a whole lot of conflicts and potential conflicts, if only perceived or apparent, it's a real issue, and there's the desire not to have this publicly facing. And we also know that doctors have a tendency to group, or medical professionals have a tendency to group around each other. I've certainly had that in coroner's hearings where they all essentially decided to tell one story a particular way to avoid a situation and their own spotlights being put on themselves. So this is also another reason for the need to have an independent commissioner, ensuring that the rights of patients and disabled people are being upheld when they're getting access to services.
Okay, still the problem, though, of dealing with a scaled-up demand.
Well, dealing with a scaled-up demand, but also only dealing with 5% of the cases or complaints that are lodged.
Oh, man. Okay, I didn't realise that.
It's absolutely shocking, Paul.
Wow.
So let me give you some figures. And these are figures actually published by the Health and Disability Commissioner, and they're actually in the consultation document. So in the 2022/2023 year, there were 3,353 complaints which were closed by the Health and Disability Commissioner. And of those complaints, only 156 were investigated. And Paul, I've done the maths, and that's under 5%. That's 4.65% of complaints being investigated by the Health and Disability Commissioner.
It's not working. It's not working, is it?
Well, it's not. And closed means unilaterally closed by the commissioner to not investigate further.
Right.
And so, Paul, I'll just jump in here to explain a little bit more. So one of my criticisms of the Health and Disability Commissioner is they have too much discretion. And so if, for example, a person makes a complaint, there were different pathways that the Health and Disability Commissioner can send that complaint down. For example, they can refer the complaint to an advocacy service. They can refer the complaint back to the healthcare provider. They can refer the complaint to other agencies, such as ACC, for example. They can call a HUI or mediation, or, and they do this about 50% of the time, they take no action or no further action. And then less than 5% of the time, they choose to investigate. And so the difficulty there is if you're somebody who makes a complaint, you have no power, no influence to choose which pathway your complaint is going to go down.
Okay, so you're completely at the mercy.
100%.
Do we know if they cherry pick cases? In other words, make it easier for themselves and then can say, well, we've resolved these ones and anything that's in the too hard basket is kind of pushed back or we'll send you this way and good luck, see you later.
That's a great question, Paul. I suspect, and I don't know for certain, but I suspect when it comes to the cases they choose to investigate, because they investigate so few cases, they would probably be looking at the most severe potential breaches of the code. So cases where patients have died or been severely injured.
Yeah.
Mm. Sounds like in that case, they're almost doing what the coroner was supposed to be doing in some respects. And now the coroner doesn't have to investigate any naturally occurring deaths or deaths that appear to be
great
arising
timing
from naturally occurring. Well, again, in response to the fact that they've got busier,
yeah.
Paul.
Has anyone come out and said, hey, we're really busy. We're not coping with this. Something's up. Something's got to happen. We have to have our resources boosted or we have to redesign how we do things. Has anyone said anything?
Not publicly that I've seen.
I have a vague recollection that the Health and Disability Commissioner may have asked for more funding, but that their funding's actually been reduced. But I would have to double check that.
Mm. Yes, the 2024 budget did see a reduction in their funding, which is possibly the reason for the report and now what they're seeking to look at and under the report. So the report is what they're seeking feedback on is under five headings. 1, supporting better and equitable complaint resolution.
Well, they already know how to do that.
I think that's endeavouring to provide an opportunity for people to meet with their healthcare providers to look to resolve
outsource,
between themselves.
Outsource the resolution process in a way.
Not outsource, but there's a huge power imbalance, and particularly if you're not well or have are requiring disability services, there's quite a large power imbalance between you and stepping into that big hospital or care centre and dealing with a professional that is specifically trained doing this day in and day out. Making the Act and Code effective for and responsive to the needs of Māori.
How do they differ? We all get sick. We all have bodies that work about the same way. Well, I mean, I'm not trying to be flippant, but how does that work?
There's a suggestion in the report that Māori don't utilise the or are disproportionately represented, or there's inequitable situations between Māori and Pākehā getting health services, essentially. So they're looking to manage that within the code and in order to perhaps resolve it in a better light that is more suitable and might see Māori use the system a bit more. Preferably, we'd just like everybody to do their job so nobody needs to use the system.
Yeah, or stay healthy, take responsibility to a certain level for your own
health.
Personal health. Mm. Yeah, okay.
Absolutely. Making the code work better for disabled people. And I do have to say there is, it's so tough for disabled people getting health services. It's the trusts that are set up, the IHC that are set up, it's really a tough gig. I'm dealing with issues all the time for people that are having real difficulty with disability services.
What sort of access?
Access to, there is a real drive with disability services at the moment to almost separate people from their families, to get in between, to fail to give the support that the person needs. A lot of the time there is this mistaken belief that a person's right to choose whether or not they get support takes higher precedence to the duty of that disability organisation to care for that person. So rather than finding an alternative way to work with that person in disability services, they just say, oh, they didn't want me to come today, so I didn't turn up. And I haven't turned up for 3 months, and their house is an absolute pigsty, and they're eating off a salmonella poisoned chopping board.
I've got personal experience of that. My dad had a helper for a while because he's blind. He actually looks after himself now because the help was so bad.
Oh.
They turned up every now and then, but they never did anything.
Mm-hmm.
That actually didn't do anything. And because he couldn't see, he didn't kind of know until he tripped over things and things like that. So, there's a bit of that about.
Probably more than what we think. So, look, the code and the Act want to work better for disabled people in that respect. Considering options about appealing the Health and Disability Commissioner's decisions, which there's no right of appeal at this stage. Perhaps there might be a judicial review on certain things, perhaps on a reasonableness or procedural error. But otherwise, that's sort of the core areas which they're looking for feedback on or looking to improve upon.
And I would just say there absolutely needs to be a right of appeal. And one of the suggestions that the Health and Disability Commissioner has, which I think is appalling, is in the consultation document, is one of their suggestions for a right of appeal is actually, if you appeal, we'll just get another staff member in the office who didn't make the initial decision to have a look at things. And I think as a minimum, there would need to be an independent panel that sits above the Health and Disability Commissioner.
Oh, dear. It's a bit like amateur hour, really, sounds of things. But that's what happens when you've got no real resource, isn't it? No capacity.
Yes. And look, the health and disability areas are under huge strain and huge stress, huge pressure. But, there's been some significant things in the last couple of years that I think has just, magnified those issues further. we can't go past it, but also there is the discussion around not only incorporating tikanga, but also including gender-neutral language. So again, not sure you know, where that's going to get to. It seems like a bit of a hangover from the last government, but it's in there. And you know, if you feel the need to make comments about it, we're encouraging everybody to do so.
Okay, we've burned through a bit of time. Anything more to say about this apart from urging people again to have their say, though, you know?
I have a quote, Paul, from Professor Joe Manning. He's one of the professors at the University of Auckland. And I'd like to read that out if I can.
Sure, go.
She says, "This is all seriously unbalanced and indefensible, given that most people, if asked, would rank health above these other interests as their most important asset. Lack of appeal rights in matters of life and death and serious injury, not even with a leave requirement, is simply not fair. The unfortunate consequence is that the Health and Disability Commissioner has too much unaccountable power. She or he is one of the very few decision makers whose decisions cannot be challenged and if found erroneous, even on a matter of law, corrected on appeal."
Yeah. Mm.
So this is why, with all the issues that we've discussed, it's so important for all New Zealanders to take the time to have their say.
Mm. And it's very easy to do. Just jump over to review.hdc.org.nz. That's review.hdc.org.nz.
Why can't people appeal? Sorry, this is banging around in my head. What is the possible reason for that? Because I agree with you. It's so unfair.
Well, there would have to be a legal right to appeal. And if there isn't, you know, a statute that gives that legal right of appeal, or like common law, a decision that gives that right of appeal, then it simply doesn't exist.
Okay. I think I know what you mean.
Well, this is a commission that has been created under legislation.
Yeah.
The legislation provides an express provision that says that that decision of that commissioner is unappealable. So you've actually got a statutory bar to being able to appeal.
No, but there'll be a reason for that to be in the legislation.
Oh, look, probably. I think that they're probably wanting to, you know, fire this in a particular direction. We don't have personal liability cases in New Zealand. We've got accident compensation for what it is, which is a no-fault, all supposed, you know, no-fault, all compensation scheme. And, you know, that's just there. And I think that they're just wanting to reduce what they perceive would be an enormous pressure on courts, which is one of the reasons why ACC came about, was to get rid of personal injury claims in courts and to try and stop them from being over, well, to just taking up court time, really, because they are often very complicated and convoluted. But now we've got a very broken ACC system.
Yeah, so you don't get anywhere there, then you go there and it's you're up against the wall again.
Yeah, and that's what a lot of people are seeing. So an OIA recently had held that of the vaccine injured, which I think was about 4,500 people who have applied for ACC as a consequence of what they say is an injury following COVID-19 vaccine, only 1,000 or just over 1,000 people have actually received acceptance or had their claims accepted by ACC. You know, the other 3,000 people were being, you know, gaslit and hung out to dry.
And I wonder how their lives are, eh?
Ah, disastrous. I deal with people every day on both sides of the Tasman, and I am gutted for humanity, absolutely gutted. You forced everyone to get these things, and then you're leaving all of those that have been hurt out to dry. Shame on you.
And so this is why it's so important for everybody to have their say. And I would just say to people, don't feel that you're limited to the topics the health and disability discusses in their consultation document. If you have feedback that goes beyond, you know, the topics, feel free to give that feedback as well.
Because tell your story.
Yeah, tell your story, because we all will, at multiple points in our life, you know, interact with the health system and health providers. And so this is an opportunity for all of us to have a voice and to have our say and to participate in democracy. And don't feel that you have to, you know, cover every single issue. If you only have 5 or 10 minutes and it's just one issue you really want to raise, then just raise that one issue.
Yeah, good messaging.
Stories are very powerful, very powerful.
And humanize it, because that's what we're really lacking, you know. So many people are lacking. If you're injured and you're not getting on with ACC, get in there and tell them. Yeah. They are the Health and Disability Commissioner. They are there to ensure that your rights to access and use health system is upheld. And those rights, I would argue, are inalienable.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, that seems like quite a good point to finish our legal hub on. Is that okay?
Wonderful. Thank you.
Wonderful.
Emma, thank you so much for coming on. Emma Cameron, it was a pleasure to have you on our program.
Oh, my pleasure, Paul and Katie.
And Katie, we'll do it again sometime soon, all right?
Can't wait. Thanks, Paul. Thanks, everybody. Have a lovely morning.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.